You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This weekend marked 2 years since Russian forces invaded Ukraine, seizing territory and launching attacks by ground, sea, and air. The fighting has been brutal, and the human toll has been high. That is deeply felt here in Sacramento, which is home to the largest concentration of Ukrainian immigrants in the country, according to the Migration Policy Institute. The death toll among both Ukrainian and Russian troops, as well as civilians, it varies greatly from the tens to hundreds of thousands, depending on the source. But numbers really only capture so much. A Sacramento-based independent journalist has been traveling to Ukraine since the very beginning, a largely self-funded pursuit to humanize the lives caught in a debilitating limbo. And he has joined us on Insight over the past 2 years to share their stories. Martin Kuz joins us now to give us a sense of the situation on the ground and the morale of Ukrainians who continue to face a conflict without an end in sight. Good afternoon, Martin.
Good to be with you, Vicky. Thank you.
We've just crossed 2 years of war, and I go back to when you first joined us in 2022, telling us about that first trip you took in February of 2022. Remind us why you traveled to Ukraine 2 years ago.
My sense at the time, after months and months of headlines about the Russian troop buildup at the border, gave me an awful feeling that this time Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, was not bluffing. And it was at the time of the Olympics, which were being held in Beijing, and China is a close ally of Russia. And my guess, educated guess, was that Putin, if he was going to launch an invasion, would wait until just after the Olympics. And as it happened, that's what he did. Only days after the Olympics, the Winter Olympics concluded, tanks and troops from Russia rolled into Ukraine all across the country at a scale that few people anticipated.
And it was deeply personal to you. Your father, Eugene Kuz, is a Ukrainian or was a Ukrainian refugee following World War II.
Right. The personal dimension of this particular war has cut very deeply for myself and my family. He had been a World War II refugee. He had fought against the Russians back in that time in World War II, and he had always warned that Russia would never settle for allowing Ukraine to be independent. And so Putin's saber-rattling, if you will, on this occasion seemed louder than on previous occasions, and that made me think I needed to be on the ground to be a witness, both in terms of my father's legacy, as well as to try to tell the story of Ukrainians to Western audiences.
I remember one of the first articles that you wrote, and when talking about your father, I mean, what stood out to me was that, you know, when he left, I mean, he never returned. He never again saw his parents or his brothers, never forgave Russia. And I think about the large refugee population we have here in Sacramento and how what's going on thousands of miles away is so deeply embedded with families like yours.
Right. Refugees escape war, but the war stays with them. They carry that everywhere. And on the one hand, you have families torn apart. You have family members back in Ukraine who have been killed. And at the same time, you're in a say if you're in the United States, you feel very far away. You feel helpless. And so that, I think, compounds the trauma that those refugees experience. And I think it's an inescapable feeling, something that they carry with them every day, regardless of the state of the war that particular day. It's that void within them. And I think my father felt the same. He loved America. He became a naturalized citizen. But there was a wound that never healed for him because he could never return to his homeland.
You arrived to Ukraine in the days leading up to the invasion. You stayed through mid-March of 2022, and then you've made subsequent returns since then. But how do you reflect on that first trip you made? How did you reflect on it this weekend?
I thought back to traveling to eastern Ukraine, a region called the Donbas, where Russian troops had first invaded in 2014. And I went there, met soldiers in the trenches who were bracing for a larger invasion. And the glimpse of that region of the country gave this awful preview of what the rest of the country might endure if, in fact, Putin launched his full-scale invasion. And I was taken back to that time when the war reached its two-year mark, because I think if the world had responded in a more forceful way in 2014 and 2015, when Ukrainian forces were valiantly fighting against Russian forces in eastern Ukraine, maybe this wider invasion could have been averted. So it's a reflection on both what happened then or what didn't happen then in terms of Western involvement, and then thinking to today and the incredible toll that Ukraine has absorbed as a result of what I consider to be poor decisions by Western leaders, going back to the start of Vladimir Putin's reign of power in 2000. So it's the both looking backward and ahead, and I think this coming year looks very grim for Ukraine.
I was going to ask, what do you want people to understand about what the situation is like today, 2 years later?
Often in the United States, we think of the war as a political struggle simply because of what is happening in Congress with stalled military funding for Ukraine. For Ukrainians, it's not abstract. The toll is real, and it's every day. It isn't always in the form of lost loved ones, but it is often in the form of missiles dropping from above, from a disrupted economy, from displacement from your home and having to live elsewhere and trying to scrape by. There is no corner of Ukraine that hasn't been affected. So when we talk about the war reaching its two-year mark and now into its third, it is this constant struggle that Ukrainians face. And this deep into the war now, there is, I think, a sense among Ukrainians that they absolutely need Western support to sustain the fight against Ukraine. And they aren't asking for Western troops to be placed on the ground. They're simply saying, please help us fight this war by providing us with the munitions and the weapons that we need. I think they're worried, rightly so, and I think that they realize that the coming year is going to be very, very difficult.
Have you been able to keep in touch with the people that you met along your reporting journeys in Ukraine?
I have. We generally stay in touch via WhatsApp or email, and to a person, that concern exists. And they ask me if I have any insight into what might be happening with funding from Congress. And I said, I wish that I did. And I wish that I had good news. And for them, Ukrainians are remarkable people. They're almost bereft of self-pity and defeatism. Despite the magnitude of the struggle, they continue to believe that their country will prevail. There was a poll taken in Ukraine in December showing that almost 90% of Ukrainians believe that their country will prevail in the end. That kind of esprit de corps, that kind of solidarity, is kind of a democratic ideal that we often give lip service to in the West. It also speaks to a bond that has formed across Ukraine that didn't exist necessarily before the invasion. There were more people, I think, who felt aligned with Russia simply because of history and roots and family. Not anymore. Now I think there is a universal feeling across Ukraine that we do not want to be under the yoke of Moscow any longer. Because even after they gained their independence in 1991, Russia continued to meddle, continued to foment corruption and disrupt its politics. This was not the first time that Russia was involved in what was happening in Ukraine. We had political revolutions as a result of that meddling. And Putin has been at the heart of that. And I think if Putin expected that he could fracture Ukrainian unity or that Ukrainians might actually welcome Russian troops, he miscalculated badly. That part hasn't changed. But the state of the war is at a precarious point.
I want to get into or just touch upon conflicting numbers when it comes to casualties, because it can vary greatly. Over the weekend, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that at least 31,000 Ukrainian troops have been killed in the fighting, though the U.S. officials, you know, say that number is likely higher. Russian troop casualty estimates can vary greatly as well, ranging from the tens of thousands to the hundreds of thousands. And when it comes to civilians, the United Nations says that over 30,000 civilians have been killed or injured since the war began. I mean, numbers kind of can become a distraction to really what truly is the human cost and the human toll. But how do you come to understand these numbers?
I think that's an important point, that the numbers can almost create the kind of abstraction in people's minds. I've seen the toll firsthand of families burying members who have been killed in the war, talking to those who have lost loved ones in Bucha, Irpin, Izum, Mariupol, city after city. The numbers reflect what you might say is the fog of war at the political level. Everyone providing these numbers has a particular agenda. I think for Ukraine, it's important for them to try to maintain unity. Do I believe the 31,000 figure? I'm skeptical, only because I think that the fighting on the Ukrainian side has been, the toll has been extraordinarily heavy. From Zelensky's perspective, as he's faced pressure to perhaps mobilize even more Ukrainians for the war effort, I think he's concerned about a higher casualty number, perhaps, preventing people from signing up or being willing to respond to draft notices. From the United States perspective, providing that higher figure, I imagine it's about what they consider to be an accurate reflection of what Ukraine has absorbed. And I would say that even though the numbers differ from what Zelensky says and what American officials say, I think people have to recognize that the Ukrainians have a much smaller population. At the start of the war, it was about 44 million. Russia has about 145 million. The Ukrainian pool of potential recruits is smaller. They're not by any means without potential recruits. They can continue to fight for many years to come. And that is something that I think is important to remember, that Ukrainians aren't about to capitulate, even though the news right now is quite pessimistic. But I think the numbers are a little bit about messaging. And whoever puts those numbers out, let's not forget when the United States was fighting in Vietnam, it routinely exaggerated the kill count. And so while I don't necessarily doubt what United States officials are saying, there is always the question, What is that underlying agenda? I'll simply finish by saying that the toll on civilians, I believe, is considerably higher than what the official numbers show. I think in Mariupol alone, which is now under Russian control, there have been estimates as high as 25,000 in one city alone. So when I see these lower estimates, I'm skeptical about those. I recognize that it's a very deliberate process by which they track those numbers, but I think the toll of civilian deaths is perhaps as much as three times or four times as high.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Sacramento-based independent journalist Martin Kuz about the war in Ukraine, which has crossed into its third year. A lot has happened in the last 2 years internationally as well, and I'm curious what role you think other events, other conflicts happening around the world. I think of the Israel-Hamas war, which is entering its fifth month. How do you think that has impacted coverage and the political will for the war in Ukraine?
I think it's had a dramatic impact. At the point that Hamas launched its attack on October 7th, Vladimir Putin's birthday as it happens, you saw a significant shift in terms of both coverage and political will in the West, particularly in the United States, with respect to Ukraine. Ukraine had already become, unfortunately, a kind of political football in the United States. And the war in Israel has created, to some degree, a kind of false diversion or dichotomy. The United States is capable of walking and chewing gum at the same time. it can absolutely have a presence in Israel, and it can also absolutely continue to help Ukraine. The debate over Israel and Hamas is one that I typically don't get into, as I don't pretend to know nearly as much as I do about the war in Ukraine. But I do think that it has, to some extent, been used as an excuse to no longer pay as much attention to Ukraine, nor to provide as much support for Ukraine. And so that has made the job of Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, much more complicated as he tries to sustain Western support. And he, too, has shown that he's tireless. He's willing to travel around the world to continue to meet with European leaders. Unfortunately, it doesn't appear that he's getting as much help as he absolutely needs.
Another big development that happened in the weeks leading up to marking the third year of war in Ukraine, Russian opposition leader and Putin critic Alexei Navalny, he died in a Russian prison. What impact do you think this has on Ukrainians? I mean, you have a really good sense of what it is like on the ground. Did this impact them, do you think?
I think it demonstrated that Putin feels invincible. I think he believes that he has an election coming up in a couple of weeks. We might call it a sham election, since the result is already known. And eliminating Navalny, his advocates have described his death as a murder, and I'm inclined to agree with that phrasing, simply because the charges which Navalny had been imprisoned on were absurd, but very much representative of Putin's autocratic regime. And for Ukrainians, look, the most immediate concern is survival. That is what guides and shapes their days. And I think that the death of Navalny signals to them that Putin will continue this war no matter the cost and no matter who might stand against him. Navalny was a somewhat controversial figure within Ukraine because of comments he'd made previously regarding Crimea, and suggesting perhaps that Crimea should remain in Russia's possession. But regardless, I think if you polled most Ukrainians today and asked them, would you prefer Navalny, the opposition leader, the man who was warning the West about Vladimir Putin and the wars that he wanted to wage, or would you prefer this autocratic demagogue who is ravaging your country? I think overwhelmingly Ukrainians would choose Navalny, but they wouldn't necessarily say we feel for him in the way that we do Zelensky. It's simply, I think, a signal to Ukrainians that this war will go on as long as Putin is in power, and anyone who dares speak against him risks death.
Do you plan on returning to Ukraine?
I do. My hope is to return in the spring, and it's an opportunity to gauge where the war stands at that point. There's a lot of talk recently that Russia's offensive, its own offensive, will begin in late spring or early summer. And this will be an extraordinary test of Ukraine's resilience and its military capacity. I'm deeply, deeply worried about what 2024 will bring, but I also believe that the solidarity and the savviness of Ukrainian forces and the Ukrainian people will allow them to endure.
We only have 30 seconds left. What do you hope people here in California, Northern California, listening to this, take away from this conversation?
I hope that people will remember that Ukraine is, at this stage, the battleground for democracy and democratic ideals. We talk a lot about that in the United States and the West. They are living it. They are fighting it. They are dying for it. If you care about democracy, wherever you may fall on the political spectrum, if you look closely at this war, you will see that it represents the ideals that the West claims to hold dear. I don't know that we would always go to the lengths that Ukraine has to try to preserve independence and sovereignty, but I hope that Westerners and Americans will remember what is happening there and will continue to support Ukraine in this titanic struggle.
Martin, thank you for the time, as always.
Thank you, Vicky.
Martin Kuz is an independent journalist based here in Sacramento who has reported on the war in Ukraine since the very beginning. We've been talking about the state of the ongoing conflict, which has entered its third year. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.